In this hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mark Evans. He is called a cultural conservationist. We'll find out what that means. And then in the second half hour, we are going to talk with Senator Mark Wayne Mullen about the government shutdown and a whole lot more with Senator Mullen. That'll be coming up in the second half hour. So right now, we welcome in to the program Dr. Mark Evans. And Dr. Evans is an educator, an author, a cultural commentator, but he's considered a cultural conservationist. And I'm going to ask him about that. He's really passionate about cultural conservation. Decades of experience in both the classroom and on stage as a musician and lecturer, Dr. Evans has inspired audiences nationwide to rediscover the enduring value of language, music, and history. Those are three things that are near and dear to my heart. He is the author of multiple acclaimed books, including Mark My Words, and the other book is Our Musical Heritage. Dr. Evans, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
So tell me, you are a musician. I am a musician. I play trumpet. What do you play?
Piano and organ. Trained as a composer and conductor. I describe myself sometimes as a fugitive from the Hollywood rat race. The doctor in front of my name, by the way, is musical, not medical. And I grew up in the music department of a large Hollywood movie studio and became enormously interested in motion picture music, jazz, musical theater, as well as the classics. And that's what has encouraged me to become interested in cultural issues today.
So have you scored any films that we might be familiar with? Did you do any music for any of the major motion pictures?
Well, nothing that you would probably recognize, but I have played both the piano and organ quite actively, and of course I'm a composer and have written a lot of music, including music for musical theater. I write everything from string quartets to musical comedy.
Wow.
I got out of school, and I was privileged to have studied under a great composer, Mario Casanova Tedesco, who taught people like John Williams and Andre Previn and Henry Mancini long before I was born. And I got involved in writing books quite by accident. I'd become concerned with students coming out of school unfamiliar with any music other than what they encountered through social media, and typically that's just rock, rap, and pop. And many haven't read a book that's never been assigned to them, and many others don't know even the basics of American history. So that inspired me to come up with the idea of cultural conservation.
Okay.
The idea that we should preserve our cultural resources with the same enthusiasm and care that we devote to our natural resources.
Okay, so hang on. I'm going to back up, though. I'm going to throw a couple of names out at you and see if you're familiar with these names as composers and arrangers of music for television and movies. Number one would be Ralph Carmichael. Ralph Carmichael wrote music for the Bonanza, I Love Lucy, the movie The Blob, a few other movies and programs that were on television. You familiar with Ralph Carmichael?
Familiar with him, but never met him, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I was good friends with Ralph. And then the other name I'm going to throw at you is Jonathan Tunick. Now, he's in the other coast. He's in New York City, and he's written a lot of music for movies as well as stage productions.
Never met him either, but I certainly admire his work. And, of course, Stephen Sondheim,
right,
whose shows he orchestrated almost from the beginning when Sondheim went out on his own,
right,
once described him as the finest orchestrator on Broadway, probably as a successor to the great Robert Russell Bennett, who did almost all the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows. But, yes, I'm very familiar with Jonathan Tunick and his work. Again, he and I just never crossed paths.
Now, that's interesting. All right. So Jonathan Tunick was actually on this program last week. So, and I didn't realize that you had any connection to the music world. But so cultural conservationism, what exactly do you mean by this, and what are you trying to do?
Well, as I mentioned, I've been concerned about these facts about students being completely ignorant of history. We're losing our language. We're in a position in which some of our greatest music is in danger of fading into oblivion. And I felt that I wanted to do something to encourage parents and grandparents to pass on this great, wonderful legacy. Ronald Reagan once said famously that history doesn't pass in the bloodstream, and the same can be said for the great art. And as far as cultural conservation is concerned, I think if we look at the cultural crisis we're in, I think this is the result of several major mistakes that we've made. We've made the mistake of assuming that change and progress are synonymous, and they're not. I sometimes quip that the phrase new and improved means a bigger box and fewer cornflakes. And we also tend to confuse fame and quality. So we live today in what I call a celebrity culture, in which people tend to worship celebrities, and we don't realize sometimes that just being famous doesn't mean that you've achieved anything.
Right.
We also confuse technology with wisdom, and that's another major mistake, because the fact that something is digitized, that it's on a computer, or you see it on your tablet or see it on your phone, doesn't necessarily imply wisdom and certainly not common sense. And finally, we tend to like what we know, and a lot of times these days, especially with students, they tend not to know very much because they're not exposed to it. So I would ask, where do we go for a solution? And the places we usually go these days for a solution are actually part of the problem. We go to academia, which has become kind of an indoctrination factory. We go to the government, which creates problems. And we go to the entertainment industry, which is the major source of problems altogether.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So I think I like what you're getting onto here. And, you know, we do have to take a lot of credit for a lot of music that originated here in the United States. And I know some of what you're doing is trying to inform the audience of this leading up to the 250th birthday of the United States as we celebrate our freedom, our independence, 250 years. But also, a lot of the music born here in the United States, like jazz music, like gospel music, those forms of music that were born here in the United States.
That's absolutely true. And this country has a fascinating musical history. Most people don't realize that a composer actually signed the Declaration of Independence. He wasn't an important composer. His name was Francis Hopkinson from Pennsylvania. But he wrote some songs that brought tears to the eyes of his friend Thomas Jefferson. They were dedicated to his good friend George Washington. And we don't know, in many cases, why we sing Star Spangled Banner or why we sing God Bless America. There are wonderful stories behind the composition of pieces like that. And in addition, of course, as you say, jazz has sometimes been called America's classical music. Jazz involves simultaneous composition and performance, and its history going back to its early days in New Orleans, through Chicago, through New York, and around the world is a truly remarkable. It's a legacy that came from Black Americans starting in the South, and it has become a kind of an international language. People also don't realize that what we used to call musical comedy, American musical theater, is really an art form born here in America, and it's the result of a melting pot of people who came to this country from all over the world, and it's a mixture of opera and popular music and excerpts from the Great American Songbook. There's also a vast repertoire of classical music, concert music, chamber music, operas, symphonies, orchestral pieces, and a wonderful story about the composers who really developed an American style, people like Aaron Copland and like one of my distinguished teachers, Roy Harris. Roy Harris, for example, was born in a log cabin on February the 12th, Lincoln's birthday, in Lincoln County, Oklahoma. And he went on to become one of the world's great symphony composers with a very unlikely background. And then, of course, motion picture music. I think there was a golden age of film scoring, particularly in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, pretty much wrapping up around the early 60s, and there's some tremendous music that's been written for motion pictures, and none of this is really being taught as it should be in schools. So that's why I wrote Our Musical Heritage, the Mark My Words book, is subtitled How to Discover the Joy of Music, the delight of language and the pride of achievement in the age of trash talk and cultural chaos. And I ended up saying you really need to light some candles rather than curse the darkness. I decided to follow my own advice and light a few candles, and I wrote Our Musical Heritage. And the subtitle there is From Yankee Doodle to Carnegie Hall, to Broadway to the Hollywood soundstage. And we have a website, culturalconservation.org, and the whole idea is to make most Americans much more aware of the greatest in our arts and in our culture. And we have these same problems, by the way, with books and the visual arts and language and history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you said a lot of stuff there. So first off, let me give the web address again so people can follow up and get more information online at culturalconservation.org. Culturalconservation.org is the website where you can get more information, folks. And I'm sure you can purchase Dr. Evans' books there as well. But so here's what's baffling to me. Okay. So in schools today, Dr. Evans, back when I was growing up, and now here we go with one of those back when I was in school stories. But anyway, when I was in school, we had to take an art class. We had to take a music class, especially in grade school and middle school, junior high. You know, you had to do those. You had to take, you know, one semester of art, one semester of music, whatever it was, or it was a rotating schedule, and you took. You had an art class on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you had music on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But we were forced into those. We had to take them. They were a part of the curriculum. There was no doubt about it. An elective was to take a foreign language. And you could take a foreign language if you wanted to, but you didn't have to. Here, now, today, it's kind of the other way around. You don't have to take art. You don't have to take music. You're forced into taking a Spanish class, which my two kids did, and they can't speak a lick of Spanish today because, you know, they had to take Spanish in school for like 2 or 3 years, whatever it was. And, but they don't know how to speak Spanish. You know, they might know 2 or 3 words. So it's really interesting how the schools have taken those programs out, the programs of music and art and so forth. Now, not history, of course, we're still teaching history, but it's not the same.
Well, that's absolutely true, and people don't realize that it's always been a struggle to get the arts and especially get music into the schools. In the early 1800s, there was a remarkable individual named Lowell Mason, who was the first to introduce music into the public schools in Boston, and he had a tremendous struggle, and when he finally got music into the schools, people insisted that he shouldn't be paid because they didn't think music was a legitimate subject for study. And later also in New England, you had the composer John Knowles Payne, who was America's first music professor at Harvard. And when he managed to get president of Harvard to agree to include college courses in music, it was again considered controversial. There was a move on to not pay him. And when he finally arrived on campus, a historian who was a rather venerable professor there said in Latin, musica delenda est, which translated means music must be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So academia didn't always welcome musicians. Now, one of the problems today, of course, that you identify is that music is not required. For many years, they threw music out of the curriculum in New York. It was Rudy Giuliani who put it back in after it had been ousted for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a struggle. And the other problem is you have people teaching music today in schools, we have very little knowledge of the history of American music as I characterize it in our musical heritage. So you even have teachers who have grown up mostly with rock, rap, and pop. Many of them have never really discovered anything about jazz or the great jazz musicians who have developed. I've had the pleasure of meeting, interviewing, knowing, working with many of the greatest musicians, and it's an eternally continual process of learning. I was privileged to have a conversation once with a great Oscar Peterson, the world-renowned jazz pianist, and he once said to me, if I study the piano for another 50 years, I still have more to learn. Now, if Oscar Peterson can say that, where does that leave the rest of us?
Yeah, really. Yeah, no kidding. And he was truly a great musician, a great piano player in his own right. Dave Brubeck, you know, I saw Dave Brubeck in concert one time many years ago here at the Greenwood Jazz Festival in Tulsa, and what a great performer he was, and a great piano player, but very well known in jazz. Chick Corea, another great jazz pianist. There's several of them. I mean, I'm just thinking of the piano players right now, but of course, when we talk about trumpet players, I can go on and on all day. Who are some of those musicians that you say you worked with?
Well, I've had the opportunity to meet many of my musical heroes. Not all, of course. As a pianist in jazz, I greatly admire Art Tatum, as everyone does. I did have a chance to meet Oscar Peterson. I had a chance to play for Andre Previn. I got to know George Shearing, who was a phenomenal pianist. I had a couple of idols that were not as well known to the public as they should have been. One of them, a man named Calvin Jackson, one of the great undiscovered figures of American music. And I also got to meet Donald Shirley. The world has discovered Donald Shirley because of the motion picture that was made about his life and his relationship with his driver, which won the Best Picture Award a couple years ago. But I did get to meet him and play some things for him. There are many, many I could list, a great list. And as you know, as when you talk about the trumpet, again, there are great musicians, and a lot of times great musicians are neglected. I had the great pleasure of once doing a show with, this was a radio show, with Dizzy Gillespie.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
One of the great legends. Gillespie, by the way, wrote an autobiography which he called To Be or Not to Bop.
To Beep or Not to Bop. That's
he
great.
Had a great sense of humor.
Yeah, well, he was something else, and I know he was a great inspiration to one of my favorites. Chuck Mangione was a big fan of Dizzy Gillespie and had him play on one of his albums, actually. So that's pretty cool that you would bring up Dizzy.
If I may, I'll tell you a very quick story. Dave Brubeck was classically trained, and he, of course, studied with Darius Milhaud. In fact, he named one of his sons after Darius Milhaud. But for a brief period, everybody in Hollywood in those years, this is back in the 1930s, 1940s, went to study with the composer Arnold Schoenberg, who had developed the 12-tone technique, which was controversial at the time. And Brubeck went for his first lesson with Schoenberg, and Schoenberg looked at something Brubeck had written and said, "Why do you use this chord?" And Brubeck looked at him and said, "Well, I like the way it sounds." He looked at him and said, "Well, that's not a good enough reason." And Brubeck never went back again for another lesson because, as typical of any jazz musicians, he wasn't interested in the theory so much as what he got in his spirit and in his heart and in his ear. And
right.
He thought if he liked the way it sounded, that's good enough for him.
Exactly. Oh, no, you're right. That's Dave Brubeck to a T. And a lot of jazz musicians have taken that as well. You know, we are just about out of time here, but can I ask you to come back on the program again sometime?
I would absolutely delighted to. It's always a great pleasure to talk to anyone about music, especially someone like you that's so familiar with these figures. And we can talk about the trumpet and talk about I, of course, don't play the trumpet, but there's some trumpeters I greatly admire. I might mention Rafael Mendez.
All right. Hey, Dr. Mark, I got to go. I'm sorry. Our other guest is on the phone. So we will talk again soon, okay?
All right. I'll look forward to returning. Thank you so much, and mark my words.
All righty. Thank you, Dr. Evans. I appreciate that and appreciate your time. And how interesting. I mean, this is really good stuff. I did not know what to expect from this interview, to be honest with you. And I kind of put it off for a little bit. And then I went back and I read the email and I thought, wait a minute, this is really interesting. And I like what he's doing. I like what Dr. Mark Evans is doing in trying to preserve or conserve, because it's cultural conservation. So we're trying to conserve and preserve, I'm going to say, our culture, the culture that the United States was built on, the music, the history, our language. I mean, oh my goodness, we didn't even get into language with him, really. And I want to the next time he's on the program, so I'm glad he's agreed to come back. But, you know, you understand, folks, that a lot of people are really, I don't know what the word is I can use here on the air, but are really butchering. That's a good word. That also begins with B, but they're butchering our English language. And granted, we don't speak British English. Thank goodness that we somehow, I don't know how, and I don't even know how in history that came about, because all those folks that settled in this country came from Great Britain. And of course they spoke with a British accent, I guess at one time, unless the British accent over in the British Isles got thicker as their history went on, as their years went on. But anyway, so somehow we don't speak that English, but we do speak English. And I try to speak properly. People still tell me that they like, oh, you're not from here, are you? Where are you from? And I say, well, I'm from New York. Oh, I knew it. I could tell. I'm like, really? I don't have a New York City accent. I don't speak like somebody from Brooklyn, okay, or the Bronx. I don't speak like that. I tell people I come from the part of the state where we speak proper English. And that was always my line, you know, because I grew up in a family that, well, I frankly, spoke a lot of Italian, especially when they didn't want me to know what was going on. But I learned English as a kid. My mom said, we're living in the United States. He's going to school here. He's got to learn English. We're going to speak English. And so she and my dad spoke English in the home as much as possible. My dad spoke broken English. He speaks it a lot better now than he did 50 years ago, 50, 60 years ago. But he did speak really bad English, broken English back then in the 60s and 70s as I was growing up. My mom was born here, so she learned English practically from day one. But at home, her parents never spoke English. My grandmother never spoke English. She couldn't hardly speak very many words or a full sentence in English. It was difficult for my grandmother, who came over on the boat, and my dad, who came over on the boat. So it, for them, it was a little bit different. But I think the next time Dr. Mark is on the program, we're going to delve into that language thing and preserving our English language, because there's so much slang these days, and there's so much, you know, as someone once said, with Ebonics, and there's this and there's this. We are just butchering our language and we are not speaking it properly. And so I always kind of tried, I won't say I took pride in it, but I was very deliberate about my English as a kid growing up through school, et cetera, because I was performing in plays. I was on radio. I got into radio and television very young. I was very young, 15, 16, 16 years old, I think, when I got my first radio job, something like that. I don't know. So you don't go on the air and just talk like a guy from Brooklyn or the Bronx, you know, in Jamestown, New York. I mean, we were as far away from New York City as you can get without leaving the state, basically. All right. That's language. Dr. Mark Evans.